I encourage anybody who's doing any research in the Mississippi Delta, just don't come and do a survey, but you really got to go where the people are. You got to go where they live. You got to walk those communities. You got to hear people and feel people's pain. And that's not really taking place. It's everybody want to come in and get a quick fix, and then they want to leave and leave nothing behind. We got to start leaving things behind. We got to empower people within the community and put the resources at their fingertips.
Welcome to another episode of Advocates in Action, a podcast created by the Patient Advocate Foundation, a nonprofit that helps promote equitable access to affordable quality health care through providing case management services, financial assistance, and patient education and advocacy tools to people living with chronic, life-threatening, and debilitating illnesses. I'm your host, Ashley Freeman, Manager of Stakeholder Outreach and Engagement, and welcome to Season 9, where we get the opportunity to amplify several stories and contexts that illustrate health justice as a community-led movement for power building and transformational change. This season is brought to you in collaboration with Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center at Virginia Commonwealth University. We are kicking off our first episode of the season with a conversation with our project partners in Richmond, Virginia and Rowville, Mississippi. This was recorded for the Association of American Cancer Institute's 2024 annual meeting.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining our discussion. The future is here, but its benefits aren't equally distributed. Perspectives from LA County, the Mississippi Delta, and Richmond, Virginia. My name is Gwen Darian from the Patient Advocate Foundation, and I'm joined by Ms. Freddie White Johnson, who's the founder and president and CEO of the Fannie Lou Hamer Cancer Foundation in Ruralville, Mississippi, and Dr. Robert Wynn, who's the director of the VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center. Thank you so much. So what we're going to look at today is we're going to explore what we learned from our project we've been doing for the past several years, which is entitled Improving Access to Care and Shared Decision-Making for People Living with Cancer and Other Chronic Diseases. It's a collaboration of the Fannie Lou Hamer Cancer Foundation, LA County Alliance for Community Health and Aging, and VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Patient Advocate Foundation. We were able to go to Mississippi, Richmond, and LA. We heard from patients, caregivers, patient advocates, and healthcare providers about the obstacles that patients encounter, patients, caregivers, communities encounter when they're in identifying and accessing optimal care and treatment. All three of our partners in all three locations, cost of care was rated as the most highly concerning thing for everybody who is looking for care for chronic and serious illnesses. We talked a lot about insurance disparities, what it means, what the difference is between having private employer-based insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, but also what happens when you're in a state like Mississippi, which is a non-Medicaid expansion state. And then also the lack of, the lack of information and how we can come together and co-create information that will help people get the health care that they need and they deserve and fulfill the health goals as defined by them, not by somebody else. So, of course, underlying all of these barriers in making optimal care available to everyone and making optimal care available to certain individuals and communities, bias, both explicit and implicit, and structural racism are the foundation of some of what we're experiencing. And I always remember what the late Dr. Edith Mitchell, one of the amazing leaders in health equity, said to me. She said, Gwen, there is no such thing as implicit bias. When there's bias, it's all explicit. We took the inspiration from this title from Dr. Robert Wynn's keynote for a convening that we did around this project. The future is here, but it's not equally distributed. So Dr. Wynn, I'd love to ask you to just expand on that a little bit and why you think that resonated with everyone.
I'm going to give some credit to William Gibson, who quipped something similar to that. That was a riff-off of that. And it is because the data shows that. You can go back and almost recognize that with every new invention, whether it's a new technology or a new medicine, we can be polite and sort of say it inadvertently causes a chasm or disparities between groups, particularly the most at-risk groups, rural, at-risk, urban, underserved areas. But interestingly enough, there is an intersectionality with that, particularly when you now have African-Americans that are in rural areas. If you look at the data, it turns out that it's almost a bad, almost like a bad dream, where things certainly are happening, but they get out to those who have access to it and can afford it first, and may get to us in some cases 10, 20 years later. And so it is true that the future is definitely here. It is just unevenly distributed. The only modification I will put to that is that if we know the future is here and we know it's unevenly distributed, then why are we still making excuses? Because once we've identified the problem, as we have for the last 30, 40 years, the issue becomes much more, not to oversimplify, but it becomes solvable because at least you know what you're up against. And it's not been so much that we don't know how to, almost like a diet. We know that losing weight's good for us. There's a thousand ways of doing it. But we know that if you usually just pick one of them and you stick with it, you actually have results. I submit to you, in the social circles, what we've done is that we've admired the problem, but we really, we even have had blue ribbon panels on how to solve the problems. But what we have not done is stuck in a very committed way into approaches that will deal with this issue. And so, you know, that's where I am. But I know, Freddie White Johnson, you know, listen, I've been watching you and I've been watching you, Ms. Gwendarian, for a very long time. So I know y'all gonna come with the information too, but that's where I stand.
Thank you, Dr. Wynn. Also, the other thing that we often are reluctant to say is that it's a moral imperative. By not doing it, we're really failing in our responsibilities as a society. We are not living up to our moral responsibility to other people in this country, because as we all agree, I know healthcare is a right, and it's a right for everyone to have equitable healthcare. Freddie White Johnson, how can patients and the healthcare providers make shared decisions if there is no access to care?
We see the research, we see the future, but again, it's not getting where it needs to really get. Here in the Mississippi Delta, everybody comes and we see people from all over that's come down here to do research, but take the research and go back home and write journals, write articles, and use it for additional research to bring in funding. But the people who they're doing the research on, those are the people that who are not being a part of the results in a positive way. And what I mean about that, you collect all this data from Ruleville, Mississippi, Group, Dallasville, Mississippi, Greenwood, Mississippi, but you take that data and you do what with it? You don't even really bring it back to the community and discuss your findings. We see research used to poor to reach the poor, and that does bother me a whole lot. The participation from the people, I'm a firm believer, if the problem is in the community, the solution is in the community, and we got to hear what the people that are saying within those communities, more or less than us coming in, getting research, doing surveys, and taking that information back. But once you get it and you compile it and write it up, what are you doing? What are you doing to make that person a person life better? So I don't see where the Mississippi Delta life have been made really better, because the resources are just so few to none. There's no access to care in the rural Mississippi Delta, and particularly among the African-American, who suffer the most from every disease that's out there, number one. So we just got to just find better ways to be fair, and we got to address real problems, some things that people don't want to talk about. You got to discuss and talk about racism. You got to talk about the Tuskegee situation, because people feel like here in the Delta, you come here, you get this research, you're using us as guinea pigs, and you go back and you make money. You are getting wealth from us, but you're not putting anything back in. And when you bring a program into the Mississippi Delta, it's here for 2 years and it's gone. So by the time the person or people realize that program wasn't existing, it's gone. So there's no resources. And then everything falls back on a person like myself, who is the project director or the project coordinator or the project manager, got to explain to the people that who we were trying to reach why the program is gone.
Well, even the way that you described it, and originally you said doing research on our community as opposed to learning from our community, having the research been, having the care and research and knowledge building be, we learn from communities. We don't learn about people. We learn, we research in partnership with communities. We don't do research on communities. As we said earlier, we're talking about all these things, but where do we talk about them? We talk about them in closed rooms. We talk about it in places where people say that they have the intention to fix things, but what are we really going to do to make that change and to have these kinds of conversations where we all talk about what we need to talk about and acknowledge what is there, but not acknowledge, just as Rob said, to admire it, but to acknowledge so that we do something about it and all fulfill our moral responsibilities. Rob, did you want to add something? Yeah.
It's funny because we don't even take into account the things that are working. Mm-hmm. One small little thing within the cancer centers, and I'm talking now the NCI designated cancer centers, one small change that we went from just looking at discovery sciences and new knowledge, as Ms. Freddie was talking about, to ultimately figuring out impact. Mm-hmm. Are you going to now show that the science is impacting the community? Mm-hmm. Do you know in the 21st century, as of 2024, there are people who say, why do we need to do that? Why is that important? What's really important is that we make the science happen. And the crazy part is when you make the argument that for the first time in history, many of the benefits that we're actually seeing, I believe, in the country, the narrowing of the gap with black-white differences within lung cancer, the narrowing of the gap has literally been because somebody had the courage, Bob Correll and others, to do the one little thing in saying we should make the people who are discovering these sciences and creating new knowledge accountable in some ways to showing that there is an academic relevance to their work by getting it into the community and showing how. What I think is that what's interesting is that we actually have the data that shows what happens when you have these things in place and when you don't. And yet there is almost a knock to almost go back to the good old days, which are very bad old days for most of our communities. I feel like that's the conversations we're having in our academic circles, that we know what has worked, but we're getting fatigued and tired of it because they say it's hard. All the stuff is hard.
Mm-hmm. And if you're not willing to do what's hard, then you're not willing to do what's necessary.
Yeah, that's what Francis Assisi said, right? Do what's necessary. And then if you do what necessary, you'll find that you can do the possible. And once you do the possible, then you can carry the impossible. That's not me. That's Francis Assisi, if you're going to get mad with that.
I was just getting ready to say, then you got programs that's on the ground, those community-based programs that are not really being a part of this whole puzzle. They need to be at the table. Your community-based program, but a program that who are actually doing the work. It's not the academics. It's not the universities. It's not the college that who are actually doing the work. You bring the surveys in, you're not doing the surveys. You got poor people out there reaching poor people trying to get those surveys done, and they're not being included in the whole process. And that's a piece that's really missing. When you implement these programs, you really need to go where the people are, more or less, than going to a place that's comfortable for you. You cannot go into my community and ask somebody to come to a meeting at the Chamber of Commerce to come over here in North Greenwood. You have to go to these rural churches that's on these little back dark roads where people live and bring those people to the table and ask them to be involved. And again, if the problem is in the community, the solution is there. And we need to really address that.
Absolutely. And we have to make that something that everybody puts out as their kind of North Star. The North Star is that the solutions are where the people are. Many people that know that I'm a three-time cancer survivor and I've been doing advocacy work for 28 years now. And when I first started doing advocacy work, sort of modeled on the AIDS activists, what we wanted to do as cancer advocates was just have a seat at the table. But now we want to build that table. And we want to be part of, sometimes we want to lead the building and sometimes we want to be part of the building. But we don't just want to be, we don't want to be invited to the table after the meal has started. And I hope that's part of what we did when we collaborated. What worries me is what's going on in our kind of socio-political life right now, and this idea of approaching many things as a zero-sum game. And I've just been reading Heather McGee's book, The Sum of Us. But it is not a zero-sum game, because when one rises, we all rise. And are there some models for change that you think have worked particularly well? How can we replicate this? How can we work together to achieve equity and fulfill our moral responsibility? How might some of the things that we're doing together serve as a model for moving forward?
I think one thing that serves as a model is the Fannie Lou Hamer Cancer Foundation. And it's because of my many years working at the University of Southern Mississippi and then becoming involved with PCORA and also with you, Gwen, from all those discussion, those meetings, we was able to take that information back to the community and say, look, we know that cancer health disparity, it exists, and people are still dying prematurely from cancer. My dad died in 1977 from cancer. And then Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer died from breast cancer. My father died from lung cancer. And still here it is, 2024, we are seeing people die prematurely from cancer. But we just shouldn't just bring the research to the community, but show the community how to be a part of the solution. And that's what we did with the Fannie Lou Hamer Cancer Foundation. We allowed the community to come in and do a buy-in. If the community doesn't have a buy-in, and then we're wasting our time. So because we allowed the community to have a buy-in, we have now see a 10,000 square feet building that's being built in Rubio, Mississippi. That project is $5 million. And people feel good by being a part of that building that's going up, which is in the heart of the Mississippi Delta. So they can say, well, I had a part of that. I gave, I participated in that. But just keep coming to the community and giving people a small portion of the solution and not showing them how to maintain. How do we sustain when you go, when you leave? What is it you're going to do to leave to make us empower to help ourselves?
Right. And that's also a really key point. One of the things that often is a pushback to patient-centered outcomes research or community-based participatory research is that it takes so long. But the fact is if you don't spend the time building relationships, it doesn't matter. If you try to do it faster, you won't succeed. And I know, Freddie, you've really modeled that in the way that you've involved the community and everything you've done and the community groups that were part of this, the Men in Black and Blue, the women who were working in, as community educators, really extraordinary group of people. And you've also never wavered in your commitment to this. Rob, in your role as Cancer Center Director at Massey, you have centered your work with the community and brought community to everything that you've done. I think that's also another incredible model for how to work with community rather than working on the community.
By the way, I was going to say that you just said a couple truths. One, that it takes a long time. But I want to have us not make any excuses for that, because it took over 125 years for people to get to the immunotherapy stuff that they're using right now, with major collapses and failures where they thought that the immunotherapy or immunology itself or that approach was not going to be very practical to for clinical use. The second thing you said was the examples. Thank you for bringing up the whole concept of the zero-sum game, because I believe that unfortunately that feeling of the zero-sum game globally is now reaching into the science, where people say it's either the discovery of new drugs or it's community outreach and engagement. But it can't really be both, because one has to drive, as opposed to saying that there is, that makes no logical sense, where if at the end of the day you want to improve lives, the new knowledge has to then be applied to not just an individual, but the communities. And so what I'm hopeful, and again, when I'm in the great, when I'm in the presence of greatness like both of you, then I understand that you have been living this your entire life. And we do have models. So when people say, well, how do you get it done? I know too, but we all know, even others in a stochastic reaction, that we can actually point you at more than just the three of us. We know that this can be done. So I want to, again, just thank you, Gwen, and you, Freddie, for honoring me with being able to be my friend, my colleague, but also our partners in crime and trying to make sure that we have impact and that we make sure that the science is brought to the community. I appreciate both of you for being in the trenches.
Thank you, Robin. Freddie, thanks. I'll give you the last word. What would you like to leave people with? What gives you hope in all of this?
What gives me hope, Gwen, is working with people like you. You got a big heart and you care. You come to the Mississippi Delta and you'll sit at the table with the underserved population. You sit at the table where people don't even have food, money to buy medicine. You heard their cries. When you go back home, you just don't go back home, but you reach back out. You send thank you notes. Sometimes it's the smallest things that really, really make a difference. And when you came to the Delta, I have had people tell me, she really cares. Her group really cares. That means a lot. But I encourage anybody who's doing any research in the Mississippi Delta, just don't come and do a survey. But you really got to go where the people are. You got to go where they live. You got to walk those communities. You got to knock on doors. And there are some doors that you may not feel comfortable. Some seats you may not feel comfortable. But if you're going to be a true researcher and a person that have a true caring heart, you got to, you know, you got to hug when you don't want to hug. You know, you got to cry when you don't want to cry. You got to hear people and feel people pain. And that's not really taking place. You know, it's everybody want to come in and get a quick fix and then they want to leave and leave nothing behind. We got to start leaving things behind. We got to empower people within the community and put the resources at their fingertips. When you tell a person they can get a grant through your organization, don't make them have to jump loops and go through all kinds of holes in order to get a little small $5,000 grant. And then you want them to do all this research, collect all these surveys for $5,000 when they done really. To be honest with you, if you were doing that work, you would have gotten paid $200,000 for it, but you want to pay me $5,000 to do it. That's too much going on and it needs to stop. Enough is enough. And we got to be the voice for the voiceless. You're already suffering. Mississippi Delta is the poorest area in the country. And there are so many people that are making money and doing research, became famous for writing articles and articles and articles about the Mississippi Delta. But at the end of the day, the Mississippi Delta still looked like it did 60 years ago. No jobs, limited jobs, no high-level education, not having no access to medical treatment, not having access to transportation. When a person tell you, well, I got cancer and got to drive 3 hours to get treatment to see a specialist, and that person pays a person for transportation, you're talking about $80 to go to a play. You think it's too high, but $80 is not too high when a person go to take a person outside of that community to see somebody, and you got an 8 o'clock appointment, but you don't see the physician until 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock. So I give him up my whole day to sit there. And so there's you complaining about the $80, but at the same time, you have to look at that person that we have given their whole day to take that person to see that physician. So we got to be more sensitive, and we got to have God in our heart. You know, if you really got God in your heart, you would try to do what's right. And you can really tell people that who are not sincere, because when you start talking about racism, you can see the expression on their face. You can see the color change and people are uncomfortable. We know racism existed 400 years ago and it still exists. And we can't change that, but we can talk about it. And when we see it happen, we can go against it. But if you don't say anything, you're part of the problem as well.
Well, thank you, Freddie White Johnson, for always saying something and always bringing, every time we work together, I just learn more and more and we're inspired and energized and committed. And thank you, Robert Wynn. And we have been making good trouble together for a number of years and we will continue to do that. One of the things I appreciate about you so much is your commitment to people. You love science, you love medicine, but you love people even more. So thank you both. This has been a great conversation, and I look forward to continuing to make good trouble together.
In the second half of the podcast, you'll hear from our third partner about what we learned together through our partnership in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, my name is Dr. Reginald Tucker-Seeley. and I'm a resident of South Los Angeles in the Lamert Park neighborhood and principal and owner of Health Equity Strategies and Solutions. It has been a privilege to be a part of this project in collaboration with the Patient Advocate Foundation and with my friends and colleagues, Gwen Darien, Dr. Rob Wynn, and Freddie White Johnson. I'm grateful for the opportunity to share a bit from our conversations here in Los Angeles. Our group in LA included those who have been engaged in patient advocacy for years, and some who are new to being the voice of the issues they or their family members or others in their community in South Los Angeles experienced as patients navigating the healthcare delivery system in Southern California. From our conversation, our group identified 10 issues that need to be addressed in our community in South Los Angeles. The issues noted will not be a surprise to anyone who has worked in or with communities of color. First, the group discussed how to get more community voices into cancer research. Two, how to get information about health and healthcare and research resources to our community in South Los Angeles that can help our community to be healthier and to improve our well-being. Three, how can we help our community navigating health insurance from work age, that is insurance through your employer, to Medicare and also Medi-Cal if eligible. Four, how can we improve our advocacy skills to help our community understand cancer and how to navigate cancer care, that is how to advocate for ourselves and for our community. Five, specifically, how can we provide support for those navigating cancer care, helping the caregiver and those with the disease? Six, how can we facilitate policy change on cancer screening recommendations that are specific for our community? And this was especially for prostate cancer. Number seven, how can we get better access to aesthetically pleasing, comprehensive, high-quality cancer care in our communities in South Los Angeles? Eight, how can we facilitate better access to our medical information in an easy-to-navigate and understandable format that is some sort of universal dashboard for our health information? Nine, how can we join advocacy efforts for universal healthcare coverage in the United States? And 10, what are some strategies to address and eliminate systemic racism in healthcare? Dr. Wynn's comments that the future is here, but it is inequitably distributed related to cancer care was discussed in our Los Angeles group as well. We know from the fundamental causes theory that when a new innovation happens, those with wealth, high household income, high educational attainment, white skin, knowledge, power, and prestige, and beneficial social connections, that those individuals have the greatest ability to take advantage of this new innovation. And this is clearly evident in terms of innovations in healthcare generally and cancer care specifically, where we see disparities across outcomes by these particular characteristics. And as Freddie White Johnson commented, that it is not only important to do the research to help us get closer to improving cancer treatment and ultimately curing cancer, but also the research that helps us to explicate and remove the barriers to those treatments and cures for all communities, but especially to the communities that the healthcare delivery system has historically mistreated and undertreated. I think one thing is clear across the Mississippi Delta, Richmond, Virginia, and Los Angeles, California, is that inequities still exist in cancer care from access to treatment and survivorship, and that these inequities are present across the country. And while the specific issues and barriers may vary by place, there are issues related to sustainability and scalability around project implementation for efforts to reduce and eliminate cancer inequities, and those issues abound across these places. I will end my comments by saying that I was glad to hear the word racism being explicitly mentioned. For too long, we have shied away from explicitly naming racism at multiple levels as the driver and the sustainer of the inequities we see in the healthcare delivery system generally and cancer care specifically. I look forward to continuing this collaboration and working towards an equitable healthcare delivery system where we all can get the cancer care we need when we need it, and that care is not financially ruinous for our households. Thank you.
I'm Ashley Freeman, and thanks for listening to this episode of Advocates in Action. If you haven't yet, please subscribe, review, and share this podcast. Your support is greatly appreciated. We enjoy connecting with our listeners, so please visit our website for show notes, resources, and ways to engage with us on social media. Thanks for listening.